The following program is a sports handicapping show. That's right, we will be discussing sports betting and all kinds of other gambling stuff, including game predictions. As you know, not every bet will win, but we do our best. Feel free to use this information at your own risk, and remember, wager wisely, folks. Broadcasting from the Vegas Video Network studios, live from the Las Vegas Strip, Covers.com presents Vegas Sports Day! And now from the sports betting capital of the world, here are your hosts, Teddy and the Professor.
It's Friday in Sin City, New Year's Eve, and you are watching Vegas Sports Day, the pulse of the sports betting world. I'm your host, Teddy Covers, joined by who? My co-host, my colleague, the best analyst in the business, call him what you want, the Professor, Dave Malinsky.
It's a tough opening to follow. Bob Seger is over at Mandalay Bay, which means so will we be in just a couple of hours. So that means it's time to take some old records off the shelf. Coming up today, we've got a college basketball team that wants to turn the page on a bitter revenge opponent. When we head to the NFL on Sunday, could we have a team that could defend Tim Tebow pretty well if their defensive game plan is still the same? And on Monday, as we break down the bowl showdowns, we think the very best thing for your pockets will come when we start working on our night moves.
Oh, Dave, you're going against the wind right here with these Seeger references. Should be a good time at the show tonight.
You found one.
Yeah, I don't think I could think of. But bottom line, lots happened last night on the hardwoods, in the bowl action. What's your first take for a New Year's Eve?
Changing the guard out here on the West Coast. One of the things we had wondered about with the Lakers, we talked earlier in the show about how they're going to have difficulty on the boards a little bit, difficulty scoring. They don't have great point guards. But could they D up, because it looks like that's the one thing this roster does bring, with Mike Brown and his defensive designs. Mike Brown, arguably one of the better defensive coaches in the NBA already, learned under Greg Popovich. You know, we've seen the last two Laker games at home, almost flawless, fundamental defense. And what happens when you do that? When you're getting in the right place all the time, when you're making the offense work hard in the half court, sometimes you see offenses simply wear down. You don't hear this talked about very much. You talk about pressing teams, wearing opponents down. But good, hard half court defense mentally wears on an opponent. The Knicks had no punches left when you got midway through the third quarter last night, very little to throw in the fourth quarter. They got worn down by how hard they were having to work against that Laker defense. Part of this is the Knicks problem, not having a great point guard. But the other part, too, is the Lakers already buying in to the Mike Brown system for this particular roster. That is going to be their best way to win. Unfortunately, watching the Laker game, a lot of it was after watching Washington Baylor. And I think I know, Teddy, I think I do, after all these years, where you just might be going with your first take.
No, I'm not going to talk about Washington Baylor. You know, why would I talk about that game?
Not going to talk about it.
Why would I talk about the fact that I had a dog that was more than a touchdown and they scored 56 points and I didn't cover?
Not going to talk about it.
No, I'm not going to talk about the missed field goal. What was it, a 43-yarder indoors? We're not going to talk about the Baylor-made two-point conversion when they weren't supposed to go for two in that instance. We're not going to talk about the fact that Baylor covered the spread on a play. You know, hey, you got to run up the middle three times. Can you tackle somebody once? You know they're going to do. No, we're not going to talk about that. All Baylor trying to do, run out the clock when they busted yet another long run up the middle. And we're certainly not going to talk about the freshman defensive tackle, Danny Shelton, number 71, who was trying to make a play on the last kick return and, of course, fumbled it back when there was all kinds of time to get through the back door. No.
Not going to talk about any of it.
Not going to talk about Baylor. Not going to talk about any of it, Dave. What I am going to talk about is email, because we haven't had a chance to answer emails on this the show this week. And I wanted to mention one from MyClips, who sent it in and basically told me to stop screaming. You know, enough with the Vegas Sports Day. Enough with the money time. And we've gotten mixed feedback on this. There are those of you out there that think Malinsky is dreadfully boring and I need to liven up the show with some energy. And there are those of you out there who think Malinsky is perfect and I need to tone it down to fit in with him. So keep the emails coming. I don't know what the right answer is. You tell us. That's the right answer, and that's my first take. Thanks for the email, Mike Lips, and at least for the last show of 2011, hey, I'm toning it down. We did a mellow Vegas sports stay at the top, and maybe we'll do a mellow money time. Don't know yet. We haven't gotten there. Let's shift over to Market Watch right now, and again, a reminder, we are off Monday. No show on Monday. Everyone's going to be watching bowl games. There are going to be multiple games on at the same time, so enjoy the games. We'll be back again on Tuesday, and after that, I don't think we get a day off until June. So from Monday, there'll be four shows again next week, and then obviously the following week back to a full five-show schedule. Now, we have enough bowl results that we can at least get a sense of what conferences and what teams are likely to attract money. And certainly, we've seen something in the early bowls that has attracted some interest so far. The Big 12, as a conference, 3-0 straight up, 3-0 against the spread. I know one of those wins was Baylor. We're not talking about that game. But the other two wins, Missouri, Texas, solid victories, wire-to-wire winners, right sides. Perhaps we'll see the Big 12 be this year's bowl team. Right now, a handful of Big 12 teams taking money as the market reacts to the success of that conference in the early bowl games.
One of the things we do is we chart these every year because regardless of whether the sample sizes are big enough to be meaningful, the markets do bet accordingly. You saw a lot of Iowa State money show up against Rutgers early this morning. Game's starting to bounce back a little bit, going back towards Rutgers 1. But a lot of that money could have been that conference money that comes into play. The markets do bet that way. Whether we agree with what they do or not, we have to acknowledge it so that if we're looking to play on particular teams, we want to time it right over the next couple of days. So keep this in mind. You know, the money gets very volatile now. Vegas is getting filled with tourists this weekend. Going to be a lot of action on games that wouldn't draw much at another time. The bookmakers have to be thrilled with Iowa State Rutgers and the two-way that they've already been able to write on that. So the Big 12 has looked good, maybe a bit of a surprise, but what's not surprising to us, the Pac-12 has not looked very good at all. Yeah, Washington could have got the money against Baylor last night.
We're not going to talk about that game.
Not talking about it. But if we look at some of the others, you know, California never got offensively untracked at all against Texas. Arizona State sort of showed up about as flat as expected to be in their loss to Boise State. So a conference that we thought was going to struggle has struggled so far. There are going to be some prime opportunities to maybe take advantage of the Pac-12 in the days ahead.
Again, you guys have been sending us great emails. We'll respond to them as time is available. Obviously, this week's been very busy, but we're going to backtrack rid of some of the backlog of the emails at the beginning of next week. Bottom line for right now, keep them coming. Let me know, should I scream, should I be mellow? SportsDay@covers.com. Your comments, questions, and suggestions are all appreciated. You can follow us on Twitter, @VegasSportsDay. And of course, you can and should be getting involved with the entire community at covers.com. Active threads and discussions going right now, covers.com/postingforum.
When we come back, it's time to head to the hardwoods and the Bulls in a big showdown in the Staples Center for the second time already this week. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Are you looking for the latest odds, the fastest scores, the most important trends, and the best matchups and stats? Are you looking for the key late-breaking information that can make you a winner? Well, Covers.com has the answer. The world's largest sports betting community gives you a front-row seat in the heart of the action, from the opening lines to the final scores. If you want to stay ahead of the game, Covers covers the numbers.
Oh, hello there. My name is Brandon Gooch Hahn, host of Awkward Silence 2.1. And when I'm not living vicariously through Chris Phillips, I'm on VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Okay, guys, it's money time. This edition of Money Time is brought to you by Covers.com. Remember, for all the key information you need in every sport, Covers covers the numbers. Let's start in L.A. Go out to the Staples Center, where right now the Chicago Bulls are about a two-point road favorite against the Clips. And we've seen a lot of money come in on Chicago already today, despite the fact that we've seen a number of teams in the second night of back-to-back situations, particularly on the road, and particularly veteran teams, really come out flat. I mean, just look over the last 2 days. We saw the Spurs come out flat against Houston last night. They didn't show. Denver ran out of gas down the stretch against Portland. They failed to cover. The Knicks, second night of back-to-backs on the highway against the Lakers yesterday, no show in the fourth quarter. The night before, Boston, no show against New Orleans. So Chicago got off the schneid with a solid win and cover against Sacramento last night. But do the Bulls come with that level of effort two nights in a row?
If ever a team is going to overcome that, it just might be Chicago. They had Tuesday and Wednesday off before the Sacramento game. That helps a little bit. And the very fact that you've already played in the Staples Center, you've got a little bit of familiarity with that shooting backdrop. The question is, are the Clippers ready for this type of matchup yet? We like the Clipper talent. We love them in the open court. But what happened when the game slowed down against San Antonio? The Clipper half-court defense got abused very, very badly by a smoothly functioning Spurs offense. The Spurs shot 56.3%, made over half of their three-point attempts. The Bulls are not offensively what the Spurs are in terms of execution, but they can get it into a half-court grinder. And this is where the Clippers are at their weakest. Who guards Derrick Rose? Chris Paul isn't physically strong enough. Chauncey Billups isn't quick enough. There's your one matchup problem when you've got those dual point guards out there. Blake Griffin, his comfort zone, playing against a good, quick, and effective Chicago defensive front court. Clippers may not be the team that we want them to be in this setting yet. This is their worst type of opponent to match up against. We kind of agree with the early Chicago money, but it's too late at this value point for us to tack on to it.
Yeah, it certainly has that pick'em type feel, last possession ball game type feel. At +2, +2.5, I'd probably be more interested in the Clippers side. There is something worth noting here, though, and you just wonder if the market's, as you mentioned, Dave, a little bit ahead of the Clips right now because of all the hype they've gotten. Their defense may not be there. And let's not forget, when it comes to winning games on the road, the Chicago Bulls have been not just good, they've been outstanding, already taking 2 out of 3 on this road trip, and last year winning 26 out of 41 times on the highway. I believe that was third in the NBA, behind only the Miami Heat and the LA Lakers. Nothing to be ashamed of, being behind those two teams in that category.
Let's switch to the Saturday college baskets and a big-time showdown in Kentucky. We've got Louisville at Kentucky, battle for in-state bragging rights. Early projections, Kentucky about a 7.5 or a -8-point favorite. Disappointing matchup for us, because, you know, when we talked about Georgetown-Louisville on this show earlier in the week, noted that Georgetown, it would be no surprise at all if they went into one straight up, but we didn't want them to. We would have loved to have seen Louisville come in 13-0, ranked as high as they are, that maybe set up a little more value to play Kentucky here. We don't think Louisville was anywhere near as good as that rating would show. It's a case of Pitino getting a lot of mileage out of a team that's had a lot of injuries, just patching it together and getting kids to play very, very hard, which you can do against a weak schedule. But they only had one road game so far. That was a trip to Butler. We know Butler is way down this year. Is it possible that Louisville may have trouble competing against Kentucky because they simply aren't good enough, which is an odd thing to say about a 12-1 team ranked where they're ranked?
Well, again, early season records, if you're trying to make wagers based on a one-loss record from, you know, non-conference results in November and December, you're probably going to have a hard time trying to figure out which teams are good, which teams are bad. Dave, you and I have made some money betting against the Illini this year, a team that started out 10-0 but wasn't as good as that record. This Louisville team isn't as good as the 12-1 might indicate, and that was clearly on display in that straight-up home loss to Georgetown. What did Georgetown do? Once they broke the press, these offensive numbers are tremendous. They shot 23 of 48, including 7 of 11 from three-point lands. And again, no easy transition buckets there, no fast break points at all working the half-court sets against that Louisville defense. Louisville shot just 41.7% in that game, and they only had two fast break baskets for the entirety of it. So when Louisville isn't creating the turnovers, when they face a team that can handle their pressure, their half-court defense wasn't very good, and their own offense wasn't very good because they weren't getting those easy transition buckets. Now, this Kentucky defense, It's really good. They're holding opponents under 40% for the season so far. 112 blocks as a unit in 12 games. And when we look at Kentucky, not necessarily the deepest squad you're going to find. Only seven players averaging 10 minutes per game. But six of those seven players averaging double figures in scoring. No one plays more than 31 minutes. And four of the six averaging two assists or more per game.
So here's what we have to appreciate. In terms of this type of matchup, when you look at the records, you think about where the programs have been, is it possible that the first six players in the Kentucky rotation are better than any player that Rick Pitino has on his roster? Yeah, you talk to NBA scouts, it's not only possible, that's probable. So in a game where Louisville has to press to be effective, that's tough when the other team's got so much better talent. Kentucky's got a lot of big guys who could throw over top of the press, possibly attacking the basket for easy scores. And as Teddy talked about, when Louisville doesn't score in transition, their half-court offense doesn't really have a go-to player yet. Kentucky's half-court defense has been smothering. We're not accustomed to laying a favorite in this type of rivalry. We're certainly not accustomed to laying points into Rick Pitino because his teams always scrap hard. They're backdoor candidates. But at a line down in single digits, Kentucky just might be a whole lot better than Louisville right now.
Let's go to New Year's Eve in Cincinnati. Great matchup on the hardwoods as the Xavier Musketeers look ahead. Line says they're about a 2-point favorite over Gonzaga, and now finally, I don't know, finally, it hasn't been that long, but Xavier back to full strength. We know what happened, plenty of publicity for what happened at the end of that Cincinnati game. The suspensions have now been worked through, and after losing three in a row early on in the suspension process, Xavier, now they're back from Hawaii, they're rested. They're ready, and they're going to be at full strength to take on a Gonzaga team that they've been pretty good, but maybe they've overachieved a little bit too so far, Dave, huh?
You want to talk about motives. And when we mentioned turn the page in our tease at the start, Xavier wants this one. Got beat 64-54 on the road against Gonzaga last year. They think they got jobbed. First half of the game, both Kenny Freeze and Jamal McLean, their two top big men, got in early foul trouble. For the game, Gonzaga goes 30-34 at the free throw line. When the two big guys were out in the first half, Xavier falls behind by 11, gets out rebounded 21-8. No offensive rebounds in that entire first half. Again, they feel they got jobs. So now here's that ability to prepare, to have that extra focus. Now let's take a look at where this game might be decided, because in an earlier postmortem, we talked about how good this Xavier defense has been. Went into full lockdown mode in end games against teams like Purdue, against Cincinnati, just shutting down the opposition and not allowing anything easy to happen at crunch time. Well, who's going to attack them? Gonzaga's got two freshman guards. That's not what you want going up against Drew Holloway and against Mark Lyons. Those guards have only played one road game together in their career. That was a loss at that Illinois team that Teddy just said is very overrated. And note, in that Illinois game, Gonzaga, 16 turnovers, only 10 assists. We may look to Xavier knowing that if it's close late, give us the defensive pressure of those guards into that young Gonzaga backcourt that hasn't seen anything like this on the road yet.
Yeah, and especially when we're talking about a Xavier team that felt they got quote-unquote hosed or jobbed or whoever you want to call it in the road loss last year. Xavier's A game is good. It's really good. And I wouldn't be shocked at all to see them bring their A game against the Zags tomorrow night.
When we come back, it's time to shift to the Sunday NFL board where the playoffs for a bunch of teams are already going to be getting underway. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Let me know when I'm live. Hi, everybody. This is Bridget Magnus of Getting Real Estate in Vegas, and you are watching the Vegas Video Network.
Livestream is your premier place to watch live events on the web, mobile devices, and connected TVs. See new events daily or broadcast your own at livestream.com. Livestream. Be there.
Let's go to Green Bay, where the playoffs aren't starting for either of these two teams just yet, but the betting markets seem to think that they are. Right now, Detroit -3 on the road in a place they haven't won in more than a decade. Total 46.5. And the thought process behind this point spread is that seeding matters for Detroit. It makes a difference whether the Lions are going to have travel to San Francisco or New Orleans in week one, or whether they get to face the Giants-Cowboys winner in week one of the postseason. If you look at anyone's power ratings, either New Orleans or San Francisco, a good notch or two higher than that for the Giants or Dallas. So the markets seem to think that Detroit very focused on the task at hand. I'm not so sure that's the case. Here's a quote from Nate Burleson, a Lions wide receiver. Quote, if we go out there and play very well, maybe some guys can shut it down in the third or fourth quarter. I'm sure Green Bay is thinking the same thing. There are certain guys who are on the bubble trying to decide if they want to play or if they'd rather be in a position where they can take off the helmet and shoulder pads in the third or fourth quarter. So we're thinking the same thing. Obviously, in the postseason, health is more important than ending the regular season on a good note.
Reason they bring that up, Calvin Johnson, been missing practice this week. He's got a strained Achilles. With the wind chill expected to be in the teens in Green Bay on Sunday, no guarantee that he's going to go out there for the full four quarters. You don't want to risk that. You got a couple of defensive linemen, Corey Williams and Nick Farrelly, who missed back-to-back days of practice. So the Lions do have some decisions to make that, yes, we could possibly have an easier game next week by winning, but we have to come back next week, win or lose, so we want to position our team best the right way. Same thing Mike McCarthy has to do at Green Bay. His team has next week off. So while this line is trying to say, well, the Lions need to win, the Packers need nothing, McCarthy will sit a lot of players, well, that would mean McCarthy would be giving a lot of starters two consecutive weeks off. Sometimes you don't want to do that. Here's McCarthy's take on this. We found this interesting during the week. We are preparing everybody to play. That was the message in the team meeting today. And the second message is that this is the first opportunity in the history of the Green Bay Packers to sweep the division. So we have an excellent opponent in the Detroit Lions coming here to Lambeau, and we are going to do everything we can to win the game. Now, that doesn't mean Aaron Rodgers is going to play the full game. We think Rodgers will start and play some. Matt Flynn has been giving extra reps with the first team in practice this week. He will play. We just don't know how much. But the idea that the Packers are going to completely lay down and not compete at all, that's not really what we're reading coming out of Wisconsin.
And you look at the stats for this one. I mean, stats, sometimes stats lie, sometimes they tell the truth. This one, I think, is telling the truth. For the season, Green Bay has 326 first downs. They've allowed 326 first downs, offense and defense equal. They've gained 5,932 yards. They've allowed 6,010 yards, but virtually even. They've been actually outgained slightly. And yet here are the Packers, 14-1. They've taken advantage of their opportunities, and they've won the turnover battle, just like they did in the first meeting between these two teams on Thanksgiving Day, where Matthew Stafford, you know, he might have played his best game of his career last week against San Diego when they really stepped up. The game on Thanksgiving, I'm not going to call it the worst game of his career, but it certainly wasn't one of his better ones. Three INTs in that loss, and Detroit never really in it. Perhaps a chance to get the monkey off his back with a victory here, but on the other hand, if Green Bay doesn't lay down, despite the stats, the Packers are the better of these two teams.
Let's go to Cincinnati in what really is a playoff game. The Ravens, 1.5-point favorites, total 38 over the host Bengals. Bengals win, they make the playoffs. Ravens win, they at least clinch the division championship and a first-round bye. And an outside chance, if the Patriots have lost to the Bills earlier in the day, they could be playing for the home field advantage throughout the AFC playoffs. So both teams are going to bring it. That means we start at the very top here. Before we talk about stats or matchups, who's more capable of playing well under this kind of pressure? Baltimore's been there an awful lot. Cincinnati? Not yet. And note that this year the Bengals have played six teams that would qualify for the playoffs. If the playoffs started this week, Bengals go 0-6 in those games. In the division showdowns against the Steelers and the Ravens, they go 0-3 straight up, 0-2-1 against the spread. So the starting point here, Baltimore's got the experience, the Bengals don't, except on the road this year, we haven't seen much of that Baltimore experience.
No, on the road this year, we've seen Baltimore stink. Repeatedly. It hasn't happened once or twice. We're talking about losses to Tennessee. The Titans, maybe they're still alive for the playoffs. At best, we'll call Tennessee a mediocre team. They lost to Jacksonville. Jacksonville's a bad team. Seattle, again, slapped around in these games, losing to the Seahawks. We'll call Seattle mediocre. And then remember what happened when they stepped up against a team that's fairly good, San Diego. Huh? That was a game Baltimore needed. That was a game Baltimore wanted. That was a game Baltimore prepared for. They were never in it. They got absolutely destroyed by the Chargers on Sunday Night Football. I've seen enough out of this Ravens team this year. I don't think they are Super Bowl material. I don't think that they are the best team in the NFC or AFC North division. And a lot of that has to do with my criticisms of Joe Flacco, who has been mediocre, may even be too good. He's been bad for extended stretches throughout the course of the last 10 weeks or so. Baltimore's only covered 3 points for it. Despite being this division winner and knocking off Pittsburgh all these times, they've been a consistent money loser for anyone who's been supporting them. But, as Dave mentioned, there are issues on the Cincinnati side as well. In each of the last 3 ball games, Cincinnati has fallen apart in the fourth quarter. Remember what happened when T.J. Yates drove the Houston Texans down the field, the same T.J. Yates that lost last week at Indy? Well, he marched down the field for the game-winning touchdown at Cincy. They lost the cover, giving up a late score to St. Louis the week before that, or the week after that. And then, of course, last week, up 23-0, nothing to fear against Arizona. All of a sudden, they're life and death to win the game. And had early Doucette not fallen down with a wide-open pass headed in his direction in the end zone, they probably would have lost that game, certainly would have covered the number. So it's a Bengals team also with Andy Dalton. Second looks may not be so good for the Red Rifle. We saw Pittsburgh with their second look at Dalton, and that might have been the worst game of his pro career. Baltimore getting a second look at Dalton, who really torched them in the first meeting. We'll have to see how the Red Rifle, Andy Dalton, responds to that second look pressure.
I think the inability of Cincinnati to play well late in games speaks a lot about that experience level and a lot about a coaching style of playing not to lose instead of playing to win. The Bengals have not been aggressive enough offensively in the second half of those games. Is it showing a little bit of a lack of faith in Dalton? Is it that rookie wearing down as the season goes on? Is it that whole second look phenomenon? Yeah, a lot of these things contribute to it. Those that as disappointing as Baltimore has been on the road this year, if it's a close game in the fourth quarter, let's still look to that experienced team to stay calm, stay collected, and if not take the game away from the Bengals, certainly not give it away to the Bengals.
Let's go to Denver, where right now the Denver Broncos -3.5, total of 37 against the resurgent, revitalized Kansas City Chiefs, who managed to lose a game in overtime last week that killed their own playoff hopes. But is this the Kyle Orton revenge game? Orton, who took over from Tyler Palco, and all of a sudden the Chiefs offense started to move a little bit. He moved the team last week versus Oakland. 21 of 36, 300 yards, but 2 INTs in that ballgame. He did not finish drives. Kind of the same problem that plagued him with the Broncos. But here, Orton's got a chip on his shoulder, right, Dave?
So much fun drama here, you know, in this one. And it would be so ironic if Kyle Orton becomes the guy to knock Denver out of the playoffs. And he certainly can. I think what's been really interesting the last 2 weeks, Kansas City beat Green Bay. Not just a scoreboard result that shows the Chiefs had more points. They beat them. They outplayed Oakland. 69 pass attempts for Orton the last 2 weeks. No sacks. And the key to what Denver's done defensively all year has been their ability to rush the passer. If they can negate that pass rush, teams have been able to throw on the Broncos secondary. Question for Denver is, now you've got that same pressure similar to what we talked about with Cincinnati. You're a young team, a lot of guys who haven't been under this situation before, been outscored by 50 points over the last 7 quarters. So what does that do to your psyche? That's a big question for Denver. Second part, too, is when we talk about second looks. Probably as significant against Denver as any team in the NFL because what they're doing on offense is so unique. There's only been one second look so far, the San Diego Chargers. They held Denver to just one touchdown the second time around, and that's a game that extended into overtime. Kansas City defended Denver very well the first meeting. Arguably, they had tactically the best defense anyone's played. Denver got one touchdown, one home run pass that they hit in that game. Outside of that play, about 250 yards. Romeo Crennel had a good game plan. Will Crennel's game plan, to quote our friend Mr. Seeger, be still the same in this rematch?
Crennel has been very good at adjusting game plans, and I'm sure he's going to do some switches for Tebow, just as John Fox will make some adjustments facing KC the second time. But it's definitely worth noting this Broncos team throughout this run, and it has been a fairly remarkable run from a team that came into the season really through the first 5 weeks, I had the Broncos among the bottom five teams in my NFL power ratings, and they weren't there, obviously, over the second half of the campaign. But one thing that Denver has not done, they've not been able to win games by margin. They've not been able to pull away. They've not been able to take advantage of what I consider to be, along with Miami, the two weakest home fields in all of football. That hook loomed large if you bet the Broncos against Chicago at home. Might loom large here as well.
Let's go to Sunday night in the Meadowlands, where it really is playoff time. The battle for all the marbles in the NFC East. Giants right now a 3-point favorite over Dallas. Total 46. We did mention earlier in the week, it's not quite winner take all, and that the Giants only need a tie to advance. Dallas must win the game. Yeah, ties are pretty unlikely, but it's one thing where it could come into play if they go to overtime, because Tom Coughlin can manage his game accordingly. Quick rematch from a game played in Dallas a couple of weeks ago, and what a dramatic finish we saw there. Cowboys up 34-22, less than 4 minutes to play, couldn't make a stop. End up losing 37-34. The final Giant touchdown drive caps a night in which they had 510 yards of total offense in Dallas without a single sack. Now it's rematch time. And remember, we did a postmortem on those Ryan Dallas defenses that have not played as well as they thought they were going to. Does the defense play better the second time around? Do they have an edge? Or do the Giants simply have some weapons that the Cowboys can't cope with? That's the starting point.
Well, I mean, when we look at the recent series history between these two teams, nothing but shootouts. 37-34 in the first meeting. As you mentioned, Dave, all those late touchdowns from the G-men in the last 4 minutes of the game, where Dallas only forced them into one third down on those last two drives. And that, of course, was a third and one, which is probably a benefit for the offense in a situation where they could take a shot down the field and then come back and go for it on fourth down. 37-34 in that meeting. Last year, 33-20, 41-35, explosive offensive games. In 2009, we've got 31-24 and 33-31. Again, explosive offensive games. For whatever reason, these two teams, both with balanced attacks, have been able to move the ball very effectively up and down the field when they face one another. I don't know that it changes in this game. I mean, we talked, Dave, you talked a moment ago about the issues with Rob Ryan's defense, and there are all kinds of issues there. But Giants defense, too, has had problems, particularly in their secondary all season long. The pass rush likely to be there this week in a way that it wasn't in the first matchup. Justin Tuck's healthy. O.C. Umenyiori is healthy. But if Romo can avoid the pressure, he's going to have open receivers downfield. And any questions about Tony Romo's health in terms of his hand after he slapped it on a helmet last week, well, those questions have been answered with some great quotes that Dave found from various Cowboys.
Look at the way that the other players talked about Romo throwing in practice this week. We start with Jason Witten, and he said, I couldn't tell any difference than normal. I go to Laurent Robinson. He had a lot of speed on the ball. I couldn't even tell he was hurt. Romo's practicing with a compression glove. It's able to keep that swelling down. So far, so good. But it may not be the injury that impresses, playing through that impresses most about Romo. Look at this poise on the stretch. Since November 1st, 18 touchdown passes. Only two interceptions, both in the same game against Miami on Thanksgiving Day. He's played with a lot of poise. People talk about these Romo late-season failures in the past. No, he's stepped up. He's gotten the job done this year. He led the team to what should have been a win over the Giants in that first meeting. It was the defense that let him down. As we get closer to game time, maybe that plus three looks attractive to back Romo in this offense, and that we don't think the home field advantage is that big between these teams. Teddy knows how high-scoring those head-to-heads have been. Home field has not shown up much in those games either. Sometimes when you get to this level of pressure, it becomes a little bit meaningless. But that's not the best thing we can do on Sunday. We do have something you can put in your pockets and take home with you, and we'll start 2012 with some profits.
Absolutely. Vegas Sports Day, play of the day for Sunday. Let's take our shot with the Kansas City Chiefs. Plus the 3.5. Get that hook. It might matter. Chiefs plus the spot at Denver. That's the Vegas Sports Day play of the day.
When we come back, now it's showdown time in the College Bowls. January 2nd, we've got games all day and some big matchups to go through. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Traditional media believes that after about 3 minutes, you'll tune out. Most Vegas media companies think if it doesn't jiggle, you won't tune in. At the Vegas Video Network, we think both are wrong. The Vegas Video Network is the first and only live online broadcast network that specializes in insider news and expert views about Vegas. We combine great storytelling with the ability to watch when and where you want, on your computer, mobile device, or television. Discover the real Las Vegas. Visit VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Let's go to Dallas on New Year's Day after New Year's Day. It's January 2nd, of course, the bowl games this year. And we're right now, we're looking at the Houston Cougars minus 7, total of 56.5 against Penn State. And this is a point spread that says, basically, Penn State's not going to show up. Penn State's not going to be ready. The Joe Pa scandal, it's still lingering in the background. Tom Bradley issues still remaining. Is the team going to come? The Matt McGloin locker room fight. All of these factors are definitely included in this number, because if you really grade these two teams out on what they did over the regular season, Penn State could be favored in this game, right, Dave?
Yeah, one reason why it also filled out at 7 instead of those 6 and 6.5 that were out there, Matt McGloin still hasn't practiced yet since that locker room altercation. But is the line supposed to move for that? Robert Bolden still may be better than McGloin in the long run, especially against this class of defense, where a mobile quarterback particularly helps. So one of the things we've been doing is talking to a lot of Penn State people, saying, you know, is the team going to be flat? Do they care? And saying, you know what, there's been so much going on there that the best place for the team to be is on the practice field. That's where they get to vent a little bit of frustration. That's where they get to close off all of those other distractions. They actually think the team might play with surprisingly some spark. And also, there are some players who think it's one last chance for Tom Bradley to be the next head coach, a guy who you could say deserves the job off of his track record. The only reason he hasn't automatically been promoted is they kind of want to go outside and make it look like there's a little bit more of a clean sweep. The unfortunate aspect in this for Bradley is, look at how many other programs already hired a lesser coach than him because they couldn't afford to wait it out. So many of these other programs would have loved to have had a guy like Tom Bradley as the head coach. So can Penn State compete if their heart is there? Absolutely. Talking about a defense that was number 5 in the nation in total defense, number 10 in scoring, and most importantly in this matchup, number 5 in pass efficiency defense, they do have the athletes to rush Case Keenum and run with those Houston receivers a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Case Keenum kind of got overlooked as the season progressed. There were so many other great quarterbacks out there where Andrew Luck got a ton of pub, and Kellen Moore set the all-time win record for a quarterback in college, and Robert Griffin ended up winning the Heisman, and Matt Barkley came on like a monster down the stretch, and Brandon Whedon for Oklahoma State had a bonanza of a season. So Keenum kind of got overlooked a little bit in his sixth season with the Cougars, but maybe some of that had to do with their schedule. We look at the bowl teams that Houston faced this year. Well, they played UCLA. UCLA is a bottom-tier bowl team. Houston, life and death to win that game, 38-34. Louisiana Tech, well, they, you know, they hung around with TCU. Were they an upper echelon bowl team? No. Houston, 35-34, had to rally from behind to sneak out a bowl win against the Bulldogs. They killed Marshall. They killed SMU. But they were killed against Southern Miss in a game that was, you know, completely non-competitive. It is most assuredly a Houston team that has not faced a defense of Penn State's caliber yet, and I'm not convinced they're going to be able to step up in class and beat them by margin.
Let's head over to Tampa, and we begin the cycle of Big Ten versus SEC matchups. Sorry, Georgia, Michigan State here. Georgia, a 3.5-point favorite, total 50. And we have to start at a base point with Michigan State. Under Mark D'Antonio, 0-4 straight up and against the spread in their bowl games. 0-4 straight up, 1-3 against the spread. Twice facing SEC teams in this type of matchup, they lose both of those games in double figures, just outright embarrassed versus Alabama last year. It looks like Michigan State is a little quicker this year. Maybe they can match up a little bit better against an SEC opponent this year. But is that really the case yet?
Well, it's a good question. But there are questions on the Georgia side as well. I mean, Georgia had a great end to their regular season, obviously after the first two losses to open up the campaign. They reeled off 10 consecutive victories prior to their SEC championship game loss to LSU, but it was worth noting in all three of their losses, the same kind of thing happened. Georgia got smacked in the mouth, and they just kind of wilted, you know, especially in that SEC championship game. I mean, Georgia dominating LSU. LSU did nothing through the air the entire game. Their offense couldn't get on track, and yet one punt return touchdown and the momentum shifted, and Georgia had no answer. It was like they were leaderless on the field. The confidence wasn't there against LSU. That game for me was a real kind of a game changer in terms of my thought process about this Georgia Bulldog squad. And you don't want to look at one game and say, well, you know, first of all, Michigan State's not LSU. You don't look at one game and say, oh, well, that's just their character. But we saw the same thing against Boise in the opener. You know, we saw it when they dominated South Carolina. South Carolina still found a way to beat them in week number two. That's what's happened when Georgia's been tested this year. They simply haven't responded well.
Here's where we can go with this one. If there are some questions about Michigan State handling SEC speed or questions about Georgia's quality, let's look at these defenses for a total sitting at 50. Unique in that both of these teams, upper echelon across the board. Total defense, Georgia number 3 in the nation, Michigan State number 5. Rushing defense, Georgia 9, Michigan State 12. Pass efficiency defense, Georgia 4, Michigan State number 10. Scoring, Georgia number 17, Michigan State number 9. Very rare that we see a 50 out there with teams that show this kind of ability. That may be where we look come game day.
Let's go to Orlando, where right now South Carolina minus 2.5, total of 46 against the Nebraska Cornhuskers in Orlando. And I know where I'm not going in this game, Dave. I'm not going to the Nebraska side. This Cornhuskers team has underwhelmed me repeatedly so far this year. You look at their step-up games. What happened away from home? Well, they went to Wisconsin and Michigan. They were outscored by a combined total of 93-34 in those ball games. They beat Ohio State, but remember that game. Don't just look at the final score and say, oh, they beat Ohio State. No, they were down 27-6 at home against the Buckeyes, and then Braxton Miller got hurt, and Nebraska got some momentum, and they kind of stole one that they probably deserved to lose. And they barely got past Penn State on an awful week for the Lions, a week where the Nittany Lions were under the intense media scrutiny. Nebraska stinks. I think both sides of the football. So my choice here, only way I can look is towards the Gamecocks, but can I trust them, Dave?
You know, we've had this lament with some of the other bowl matchups that play on teams were against each other. Now here's the opposite. We'd like to play against both of these teams if they were up against someone else. Let's look at these South Carolina seniors and their bowl track record. 0-3 straight up and against the spread, losing to the spread by 46 points. They have not managed their time well. Steve Spurrier has not had good game plans for these bowl settings. Now we'd have to lay points into Nebraska. On the appearance of South Carolina had a better season, but here's the problem with that appearance. It was the luck of the draw for South Carolina in SEC play. LSU, Alabama, they avoided both of them. Even having avoided the two best defenses in the country, the offensive numbers weren't very good. Yeah, Connor Shaw is an upgrade over Steven Garcia at quarterback, but boy, they missed Marcus Lattimore. Brandon Wilds had some decent numbers as the backup, just not the same type of runner. And how can you not get the ball more to Alshon Jeffrey? We thought he might have been the best receiver in all of college football. You got guys like Justin Blackman and others getting triple digits in receptions. Alshon Jeffrey, he didn't get to 50 this year. This is an offense that didn't click, but the markets think that it did because they didn't see him against an LSU or an Alabama. So yeah, we'd like to play against Nebraska, but can we do it with South Carolina?
And the other issue with South Carolina, let's forget, this team lived and died with their defense this year. They had a phenomenal, in terms of talent, their defense is certainly the more talented of these two units, but let's not forget, defense coordinator Ellis Johnson, he's already left. He took the Southern Miss head coaching job, leaving South Carolina without their, I guess he's not their top quarterback, leaving without South Carolina without their top rusher and their top defensive mind as they look to knock off Nebraska.
When we come back, we're going to go to the bowl they call the granddaddy of them all, and then a big showdown on the nighttime board. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
No pressure. Hi, I'm... Hi, I'm Dennis Overs from... Can't think of the name on my damn show. Golf and other four-letter words, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network, I think.
Yes, this is probably going to be the longest edition of Vegas Sports Day in the show's history. It's also the first time that I guess we're setting a record for the most money times in a single edition of Vegas Sports Day. But the bottom line is, we got a lot to talk about. It's going to be a long and busy weekend for any serious sports bettor. And I know you're serious because you're spending time with us. Let's go to Jacksonville, where Florida, the Gators, -2, total of 44 against Ohio State. And Dave, you were talking about bet against versus bet against in the last Big Ten SEC matchup. This one kind of has that same feel because I'm not real thrilled about either of these two squads come Monday.
Very disappointing seasons for both teams. Ohio State had some suspensions that they had to try to overcome. Florida had a lot of injuries. So on paper, we thought this was going to be a great Florida offense. Finally had Brantley, a senior quarterback, with some weapons that he could throw the ball to. If you got Chris Rainey and Jeff Demps, how much fun can you have? But they were hampered. All three of those players were hurt, and they had Charlie Weiss on the sidelines. And we've talked about Charlie in our postmortems before. Even when those guys were healthy, he never was able to put an offense together that utilized their talents. But is there a little bit of a caveat that we need to talk about here? Yeah, Florida's going to be rated number 101 in the nation in total offense. But remember a couple of days ago when we told you how good the Texas defense was when you factored the difficulty of opposition? Let's look at this Florida schedule of the defenses that they faced. Alabama, LSU, Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida State. For our money, those were five of the top eight defenses in all of college football. So could it have been a case of the defenses they faced also keeping those Florida numbers down? Okay, now everybody's healthy. You're practicing in good weather. And you know what? If it's bowl time, you open up the playbook. You let the kids go out and have a little bit of fun. Could it be that this Florida offense may finally show us something?
Maybe, because this is this Ohio State team. You know, they essentially lost at home to Toledo. You know, I know that the guy made the wrong read, and they ended up getting stopped inside the 20, and Ohio State came away with a straight-up win in that ballgame. But bottom line is, from that point on, I thought their mentality was shot, and they didn't play very well. They didn't play like the team that had won seven consecutive Big Ten titles on either side of the football. There was a talent drain out of Columbus last year. It was a full rebuilding mode. You didn't think that Ohio State hasn't been a rebuilding team in a decade and a half. But there was no reload this year. It was a rebuild. And you look at the offensive side of the equation, you know, half the time the offense was just Braxton Miller's legs. Their passing game wasn't there. Eight of the last 10 games, Ohio State failed to complete half of their passes. And yes, they'll be taking a step up in defensive class here. Make no mistake about it. The Florida Gators defense, as good or better than anything you're going to find at the Big Ten level. And Braxton made some, you know, he made some big passing plays, but he was erratic. The running game was erratic. The wide receiver play was way down this year compared to where it's been. Buckeyes weren't, you know, I know that Florida played this brutal SEC slate. Maybe all those defenses are as good as they are because they got to face Florida this year, but Ohio State, like Nebraska, another Big Ten team I don't want any part of on Monday.
So now the quality steps up. It's BCS time. And we'll start with the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. We're looking at Oregon, a 5.5-point favorite, total 71.5 over Wisconsin. And right off the bat, we've got to question this line. It's something we've talked about with Oregon on the show in the past. It's that public perception, because when they're good, they look pretty. You get explosive plays. You see all that speed and that dynamism on the field. But pretty doesn't always equate to quality. And guys, that's a warning for you coming out to New Year's weekend in Las Vegas. A lot of the things you're going to see the next few days, maybe not quite as good as that first glance. What's happened when Oregon has had to step up under Chip Kelly? It's actually been ugly. There have been four games where they've played a BCS caliber opponent that had time to prepare. Season openers against Boise State and LSU, bowl games against Ohio State and Auburn. How did Oregon do? 0-4 straight up, 0-4 against the spread. But there's something maybe even more significant than the straight up and the spread counts. Let's look on the field in the stat column. In those games, they were outrushed 860 to 456. That's what you do if you're Oregon. You run the football. That's the key to what you do. In those showdown games, they averaged 114 yards per game over land. Tells us a couple things. One, if a good opponent has time to diagnose that Kelly offense, it's easier to solve. Two, those players in the trenches maybe aren't quite BCS players yet.
Yeah, that may well be true, Dave. But when we look at the Wisconsin side of the equation, we have to question this defensive team speed. Because, you know, we saw Michigan State run the ball down their throat twice. Not once, but twice. That's a concern on the Wisconsin side of the football. The speed issue here is very, very real. The Badgers didn't face a whole lot of no-huddle looks. They were able to get players on and off the field, change their defensive packages throughout the course of the regular season. That's not going to happen here against Oregon. Oregon's going to run their offense like Baylor did last night, where you're not getting anyone off the field. And if you're beaten down by the fourth quarter, you're going to be really beaten down. That is definitely a concern, but that's an if. As you mentioned, those Oregon numbers with extra time to prepare against that defense. And again, you know, the four games, Boise, LSU, Ohio State, Auburn, Wisconsin's probably in that category. You know, I don't know if they're quite as good as Auburn was last year, quite as good as LSU, but they're not far from those squads. When we look at their overall power rating number, for example, and the one thing about this Wisconsin team is that they could trade points with anyone. That offense has been dynamic. Russell Wilson, 191.6 passer rating. That's the second best ever. Oh, he didn't make it to the Heisman final stage, did he? kind of crazy. They ran for over 200 yards against six of their seven bowl opponents. So this is a Badgers offense. Even if the defense gets gassed a little bit, they're capable of taking time off the clock, keeping Oregon's own offense off the field, and putting up points of their own.
So if you're thinking this game, well, sounds like, well, they can line up, play smash mouth, slow the game down. Go back 2 years ago, Ohio State did the exact same thing as an underdog against Oregon on this field. And you can see as the game played out, Ohio State wasn't supposed to be the underdog. And that's the key here, is we're saying that the line is wrong. When you look at the pedigree of these programs the last couple of years, they're about even. There's nothing that says that Oregon is supposed to be this big of a favorite, except they look prettier when they're making things happen. So there's a lot of value to be found there. But where there also might be value, in a game where both offenses look really good, that's a high total for the flow that we might see. Again, Wisconsin's defense is a step slow, but they'll be fundamentally sound. They'll have the right guys in the right places. The Wisconsin offense, run the play clock down, run the football, manage the clock a little bit. They might be projecting a lot more points than we're going to see out of this game. Maybe a little bit of Wisconsin and under both heading to our pockets before kickoff.
Let's go to Glendale, Arizona for the final game on the day after New Year's Day with the Bulls. You know what I'm talking about. We're going to Glendale with Oklahoma State -3.5, total of 74 against the Stanford Cardinal. And this is a bet on versus bet on. This is two teams that I was very disappointed to see matched up against one another. But at the same time, Dave, there are certain factors that may get us into play in this one, right?
One of the things that will happen over the course of the next couple days is you'll see a lot of people break this game down, and they're going to do it wrong. They're going to talk about this Stanford taking advantage of a weak Oklahoma State defense, an Oklahoma State defense that was number 107 in the nation. Well, throw the 107 out. That has absolutely no bearing on the way they play defense. Why are they 107th? Because that's based on how many yards you gave up. Well, they were on the field for 1,008 offensive plays. Mark that down, 1,008. Now, the number one defense in the country, Alabama, they were on the field for 676. See a little bit of a difference there? Yeah, if you're on the field for over 300 more plays than another team, you might give up a few more yards. Now, let's look at this game. Stanford, number 25 in the nation in total defense. They were on the field for 758. So here's number 25. Here's number 107. Yards per play, Stanford 5.25, Oklahoma State 5.31. Almost identical yards per play. It's how many plays they faced that caused those ratings. And if you look at the quality of the offenses that Oklahoma State faced compared to the quality of offenses Stanford played, Oklahoma State's defense may actually have been better. That tells you a starting point that we have to work from here, that we think that defense is much better than the stat show. That's why this line is as low as it is. Because in a game with two good, solid veteran quarterbacks, one guy's got a whole lot more speed to work with. We think that'll make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about some of these stats. In college basketball, sometimes you're going to look at a game and say, wow, this team allows 48% shooting and their opponent allows 41. The 41% shooting team clearly has a better defense. Then you look a little bit deeper inside the number and see the team that allows 48% shooting forces 19.5 turnovers per game and gets all these easy fast break buckets off those turnovers. So the field goal percentage stats don't look as pretty, but the overall defense is better. What's Oklahoma State done this year? Man, they forced turnovers. I mean, that defense, game in, game out, has been a turnover-producing machine. And so many times, that Cowboys offense, they score 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, leaving the defense on the field for extended stretches. So they've had all of these garbage time points against them, all these garbage time yards against them. When we look at that Oklahoma State offense, come on, you guys saw the Oklahoma State, the Oklahoma game. They dominated Oklahoma's defense, a unit that's probably better than Stanford's on the defensive side of the football. I've yet to see a defense this year that slowed down Brandon Weeden and company. And you can teach the game plans. You can teach schemes. You can't teach speed. Oklahoma State with speed edges on both sides of the football in this one.
The last time Oklahoma State played, we threw up a Play of the Day logo on them against Oklahoma. We're going to do that again. We're going to lay the 3.5 with Oklahoma State as our Play of the Day for the January 2nd Bowls this year. We got to get used to that a little bit. Big key, talk about that speed into a Stanford defense that only has 6 interceptions all season. That's not very good. Stanford didn't play a bowl team on the road this year. The only qualifier would have been Southern Cal. Had to go to triple overtime to escape that one. The speed of Oklahoma State going to be a little bit too much. Our moves on Monday are night moves.
Excellent, Dave. Excellent. Bring it back to the Seeger start. We'll be at Seeger tonight. We'll be in front of the TVs all weekend long. I'm sure you will be as well. Enjoy the New Year's. Do it safely. Do it with great health. And do it with money in your pockets. Thank you so much for taking time to watch our show. For Mr. Malinsky, I'm Mr. Savransky. Enjoy the games. We'll see you in 2012.